Good morning, everyone. On this beautiful day, made more beautiful because we are so honored and privileged to have Chief Judge Young from the Southern District of Illinois joining Judge Williams and myself.
Indiana.
Hoosier.
Oh, there's another state. I always
Hoosiers.
Forget about that state. And we're also honored and privileged to have his law clerks here with us. And why don't you stand so that everyone can see? There they are. They make them beautiful in Indiana. All right, here we go. Quite a day. So, our first cases are 083690, 083759, 084076, 084246, 084320, 091864, 092174, United States versus Vallone et al. And if the rest of you want to go shopping for a few hours, go ahead. Come on out.
May it please the court, my name is Richard Kamen, and I've been asked...
Do all the arguing.
Yes. What I've been asked to do, Your Honor, is to address the issues raised in the joint brief. Because of conflicts and because of the nuance, if the court has issues directed to individual defendants, their lawyers here and are prepared to address those.
Thank you.
That said, Your Honors, let me start with the fact that each of you knows from your experience what a trial looks like, how it should be, what feels right, what doesn't feel right. And each of you knows that the proceeding in which the district judge sought in the middle of trial, an 11-week trial, to substitute a lawyer who didn't know anything about the case, who had no contact with the defendant, who really just happened to be the duty officer from the federal defender's office on duty that day, into the trial because one of the defendant's lawyers had a 2-day case of the flu. That was that no judge with the youngest judge with the least experience would know that that was inappropriate. And that is what happened in this case. Now, it was stopped when the chief of the criminal division intervened about an hour later and told the judge, we can't defend this on appeal. But that gives, hopefully, a measure of what was going on throughout the course of this trial, because throughout the course of this trial, limitations on evidence, rulings that eviscerated Crawford.
But let's go back for a moment to that issue. Because, of course, ultimately, Judge Norkel did see the error of his ways, called a halt to the trial until Mr. Vallone's counsel returned, and the government offered to re-present the relevant testimony, which, of course, was that offer was rejected by Mr. Vallone's counsel. Wouldn't that have been enough to cure any harm?
Absolutely. That is not error. That just simply demonstrates in our mind the overall ways in which this case was unfolding. That this was one of many, many, many rulings where the judge acted improperly. And so, if you will, it's the tip of the iceberg.
Well, I take it you believe that that's the worst of the lot.
Absolutely not.
Oh,
there
okay.
are others.
Well, give me the worst of the lot.
Well, we could. We have.
My heart can take it.
Let me start with what I think is the worst of the lot. When Mr. Bertoli was testifying, he was cross-examined about a case that he claimed he had not read. When he made that statement, the district judge essentially, emphasized his statement, is that your testimony? Is that your testimony? Sounding very much, or at least it reads very much, like a prosecutor setting up a witness in the grand jury. But then he went on and allowed extensive cross-examination about the case even though the relevance of the case was to mention, not necessarily critically, the so-called Stradley letter. And the prosecutors were allowed to point out that the conviction in that case had been affirmed by the Tenth Circuit. When on redirect, Mr. Vallone's attorney attempted to elicit, well, why doesn't that change your mind? He was precluded from doing so because Mr. Vallone had only just read the case. So the fact that he had only just read the case couldn't bear on notice, but the fact of the case that he hadn't read bore on notice. And everything was a double standard. Anything that was good for the prosecution on the issue of notice came in. Anything that tended to rebut the issue of notice was excluded or marginalized. Other examples abound.
Can you cite to us any example of a way in which Judge Nargle's notice to one is notice to all ruling was ever communicated to the jury?
Well, I think never specifically that I can recall, although there was an awful lot of colloquy in the presence of the jury in which that was discussed. And in the length of the record, I can't draw on a single on an instant, but I'm not saying there were none. But the effect.
There really was no specific statement by Nargle to that effect, right? Because clearly we look at it. Nothing has been pointed out to us where that specific statement was made.
That's correct. That's correct.
And of course, the government did not argue that theory.
Well,
so what I'm trying, you know, I really am trying to figure out, because we have to, what prejudice was there, particularly, to Mr. Dunn, unless you'd prefer for.
Well, I'd really like to keep it more general, since I promised that I wouldn't take advantage of the fact that I have the podium. But in the way the case was structured and presented by the government, the notion of notice to one was notice to all, and the documents coming in, you know, the Bertoli documents, the Vallone documents, the Aegis documents coming in, the entire thrust of the trial was essentially to link all of these people, fair enough, but to preclude the individual nuanced determination that each individual was allowed to assert under cheek. The rules that might, or the issues that might have affected, say, Mr. Dunn or one of the other defendants, and the evidence of under cheek that might have affected one of the other defendants, Mr., would be different than perhaps Vallone or Bertoli. And all of this precluded any kind of nuanced approach. The defendants were, as a practical matter, by the judge's rulings, linked inextricably so that.
So you're saying that the defendants were not free to argue that they individually lacked notice or to put on evidence that they individually, personally lacked knowledge.
They were absolutely free to argue it, but they weren't allowed to, but they were really not allowed to present on cross-examination the evidence that would have supported that. For example, Your Honor, prosecution served several search warrants and seized over $1 million documents. The government took several dozen documents, and in their minds, that was proof of notice. Some came from one office, some came from another. The defendants were precluded from offering documents, putting those first documents in a different light.
Well, wait a minute. Are you now talking about the cheek defense?
Well, I'm talking about the cheek defense, and I'm also talking about the limitations on cross-examination.
Yeah, but so you're suggesting basically that Judge Nargle erred when he precluded questions into the objective ambiguity of the relevant tax regulations?
What I'm referring to is that there were documents from which the jury could have inferred that there were two sides to this issue, that it was not as clear-cut as the as the government wanted to present.
Yeah, but again, I'm going to repeat my question. Are you suggesting that there was error when the judge precluded questioning into the objective ambiguity of the relevant tax regulations? Is that what you're
saying? I'm understanding your question, yes, Your Honor.
Why wouldn't the issue of objective uncertainty in the tax law be a legal question for a court rather than for a jury? I mean, subjective uncertainty is really what the Cheek defense covers.
Absolutely. And because they're subjective, because it's a subjective judgment, ambiguity is important in supporting the judgment. Cheek allows you to have a good faith, objectively unreasonable view. So you can be wrong under Cheek. You can absolutely be wrong under Cheek and still be entitled to assert the Cheek defense.
So you're saying that objective uncertainty, I just want to be sure, that objective uncertainty in the tax law is a legal question. I'm sorry, is a jury question, not a legal question for the court. Is that what you're saying?
It's not necessarily a jury question, but the defense has a right to present that in support of the Cheek defense. The law,
you're saying you can be, as long as you have good faith, you can be wrong.
Yes, absolutely. That's the Cheek defense. You can be objectively wrong, you can be wrong as can be, but if you really believe it, not as a tax protester, but you're just wrong, you're entitled to assert the defense.
And you're saying the judge wouldn't allow your clients to present their good faith?
He would not allow the evidence supporting
good faith.
He essentially required the defendants, the only way in which they could affirmatively sort of present stuff is to testify. And even then, when Mr. Fallone, for example, testified, the cross-examination was about all manner of items that he maybe hadn't read, all supposedly going to his notice.
How did it have come in other than Mr. Fallone? How would this evidence that you say...
Well, it was evidence that was obtained from in the same searches that the government's evidence came from. Essentially what happened is the government's evidence came from these searches and the defense was precluded from offering, if you will, counter evidence, documents.
What were those documents?
They were documents suggesting to the defendants. They were documents suggesting to the defendants that the law was ambiguous and that this was not as clear a question at the time as the government was asserting. And it was a whole host of documents that sometimes came out of the same room or even the same file drawer, and the defense was precluded from offering
them. The grounds that the judge kept those documents out is?
It was kind of a moving target. Sometimes he would say, you're not allowed to present documents during the government's case in chief. You can't present documents during cross-examination. That's exactly what happened. Sometimes he would say, you cannot, this doesn't go, you know, these documents go to notice, you can't show those. Sometimes he would say, you're trying to litigate the lawfulness of the AEGIS system, and no matter how much the defense lawyers attempted to reassure the judge that that was not the case, he simply wouldn't relent. So there was kind of a moving target.
Case was presented. Was there an attempt to offer these documents?
In some cases.
And specifically, you know, why did he not let them in? Was it a foundation issue? Did it go to this confusion?
My memory is that the target at the time the defendants sought to offer documents during their case in chief was the fact that these were notice documents and it's a different situation. It varied from time to time. For example, sometimes the government was allowed to take a document that was not in evidence and cross-examine witnesses from that document. When the defense attempted to do the same thing, they were precluded from doing that.
Can you give us an example of such?
And was there an objection to that?
Yes, yes. I mean, there was all manner of objections, Judge. We have a right to do this. Let me see if I can. It was certainly during the direct and cross examination of Agent Pryas. That was certainly a big factor. Who was the case agent under whom, as I recall, much of the documentary evidence came in, and the other agents who offered the documentary evidence. Additionally, for example,
but they were allowed to testify to documents that weren't admitted into evidence.
They were allowed to cross-examine about documents.
Cross-examine documents.
But, for example, here's how it became. At one point, there was a document in evidence that the government had put in evidence. Then I think it was I'm not sure whose lawyer was. It's Mr. Schindler, attempted to read the document to the jury during his cross-examination to explain that there was a different view and was precluded from even reading a document in evidence to the jury. And so over and over and over again, there was the structural...
And this document you referred to, can you just identify that document by name?
In the rebuttal section, I just don't have that at my fingertips, but I know one of the others will, and I'll provide that to you. For example, one of the things that happened, the government, these folks were out selling material, selling these systems, and they gave a lot of speeches. The government took portions of the speeches and placed those in evidence. There were, in some cases, limitations on the defendant's ability to put other portions of the speech in evidence or even the whole speech. Now, that sort of ebbed and flowed, but it was a very unusual situation. Again, with respect to Mr. Bartoli, but I think this affected everybody, given the court's instructions, because everything's interrelated. The evidentiary issues relate to the cheek defense, which relate to the court's instructions, it's hard to kind of parse it out. But when Mr. Vallone testified, certainly during the government's case in chief, they offered evidence of Mr. Bartoli's ARDC hearing. Now, Mr. Bartoli had not been at that hearing. He was ill. He was in North Carolina. His lawyer attempted to point that out and was told by the court, no, you can get into that on cross-examination. Because he concluded, he said, this doesn't give us any notice. This shouldn't even be admissible to Bartoli, much less any of the others. And the judge said, you can get into it on cross-examination. And then when you look at the cross-examination, he was precluded from getting into it. And what happened there as to Mr. Bartoli was the hearsay of the witness, Martusik, I believe it's pronounced. But as to the other defendants the jury was being told, this program is not defensible, which maybe was true, but the jury was being told that in a way that was double and triple hearsay as to the other defendants. And Crawford was out the window because it was all notice. So everything that was notice essentially eviscerated all the other rules of evidence. Now, when we get to the instructions, if you look at the instructions, instruction 27 suggested in great detail why this program was not proper, was illegal. But that was an issue that was not before the jury. It simply wasn't before the jury, and this judge had referred to that instruction as, I think the word he used was draconian. Everybody understood the effect of this instruction was essentially to direct a verdict. But additionally, the jury was not given an instruction that a revenue ruling, I don't recall the name of it, that a revenue ruling does not carry the force of law. And then when the Cheeks instruction came, it was not just the pattern Cheeks instruction. It was a Cheeks instruction coupled with sort of some language inserted at the request of the government saying essentially, and this is my term, and it says it more elegantly than I'm going to say it, if you're a tax protester, you're not entitled to the Cheeks.
Yeah, but
Cheeks defense.
Look, Instruction 27 didn't foreclose the defendants from pursuing a Cheek defense. It in no way, it would seem, precluded them from contending that they believe that the Aegis Trust system wasn't a sham, but, you know, rather effectuated a legitimate substantive transfer of assets from individual taxpayers to their trusts. Why wouldn't it be that it was evidence that demonstrated that they were a sham that was designed to evade taxation that doomed the Cheek defense, certainly not that instruction.
Had the defendants been allowed to really present the Cheek defense and they had then been convicted, so be it. The best defense to the Cheek defense is a jury verdict, as the Reagan case from the, I think, Ninth Circuit says. But more importantly, there was no need for Instruction 27. That issue had been taken away from the jury. If you needed an instruction regarding the illegality, it could have been handled with one sentence, not all of this language about income, and it simplified an issue that was enormous. Well,
surely you're not arguing that the instruction was an inaccurate statement of tax law.
I think it was an oversimplistic statement of tax law in this case.
Why wouldn't it be an instruction that educates the jury on a basic relevant principle of tax law?
As Judge Easterbrook said, it was an unnecessary instruction. This was not an issue for the jury. They were told at the beginning that the legality of the system was not at issue.
But am I wrong if I think that instruction talks about the general tax principle that income is attributed to the person who earns it, and when a trust or corporation is a sham without economic substance, then the tax code looks to who is really exercising control over the income that is nominally in the hands of the corporation. I mean, am I wrong if I think that?
You're not wrong, but it was unnecessary in this case. And coupled with the other instructions, the Cheek instruction as modified, the Ostrich instruction, the failure to give the instruction that...
Well, the Ostrich instruction. I'm sorry, you finish your thought.
The failure to give the instruction regarding the effect of the revenue ruling, all of those together, as the given the evidence and given the limitations on the defense evidence, given those two factors, were absolutely all that was missing was an instruction. You're instructed to find the defendants guilty.
Well, you were going on to the Ostrich instruction, and my question is this. Would it not be a fair inference, at the very least, that these defendants deliberately blinded themselves to the variety of warnings that they received as to the illegality of the Aegis system?
I would characterize it differently, Judge Rovner. I would characterize it that they saw it, they read it. If you accept all the notice, that the notice evidence was really notice, they simply rejected it. They didn't blind themselves to it. They rejected it. Perhaps...
Well, that's even worse than an ostrich instruction.
Well, no.
An ostrich instruction gives you a little bit of a chance. If you're going to give an instruction that says, they blinded themselves or...
They disagreed. They read the law differently. They were wrong, but they read the law differently. That's different than it's not indifference, it's disagreement.
But you're not allowed...
But let me just ask one question about Ballone. Wasn't there evidence at trial that showed that Ballone did not wish to seek clarification from the IRS regarding Aegis and actually dismissed the suggestion as ridiculous? And why isn't that sufficient to be deliberate indifference or conscious avoidance?
And that may be as to Mr. Ballone, but essentially what was happening is what was indifferent to him was then being spread to all of the other defendants. They were all being essentially tarred with the same brush, no matter what the differences in evidence was.
But he's not the only one that saw those reports.
Quite honestly, it's not altogether clear who saw the reports and who didn't, because the government was required to prove was that the reports were found in certain locations among millions of documents. I mean, it wasn't like some of this stuff was just sitting on the defendant's table. It was among millions of documents that were spread throughout various offices.
Was Dowd personally in possession of a file with all the adverse rulings against a trust of this type?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Wasn't Dowd personally in possession of a file with all the adverse